The opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host and guest and are not necessarily those of WSTU. WSTU does not endorse products that may be mentioned. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited without written consent of WSTU. It's time now for A Priest and a Rabbi. Call in with your questions, 220-9788, 220-WSTU. Now, here's your host.
And the views and opinions expressed do not reflect the views of St. Mary's Episcopal Church and Temple Beit Hayom. Now, here's your host, Rabbi Durbin and Father Christian.
Good morning, St. Mary's. Your two favorite clergymen at 9 a.m. on a Friday morning are back here in the studio to talk about all the good stuff from everything from Beverly Hills 91210 to Judaism and Christianity and faith in general. So, Rabbi Durbin, good morning to you, my brother, and may I add a happy anniversary.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It feels good to have been married for a decade. Feels real nice.
How does that woman put up with you? Tell me. What's the key to her putting up with Rabbi Durbin?
Lots of sleep. Or I should say, from my wife's perspective, a lot of lack of sleep.
Well, good man. Well, you know, we had a fun show last week. It was the first time. It was the opening day, first pitch. And we went out and really talked about our makeup of why you became a rabbi, why I became a priest, how you and I got started hanging out, which was fun. And may I add, last week, here's the pop quiz. Let's start off with the pop quiz of every radio show. Last week, we were in such a rush to get here, to get to this show, to bring the information to the people. And one of us got pulled over by the police.
And so the question here for those of our listeners is, which one of us do we think may have been pulled over by the police for expired tags and not coming to a complete stop before being pulled over?
And that person also was let off with a warning.
With a warning.
Yes. Without saying that they were clergy.
Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. Which brings another topic, you know, because today our topic is really going to be about what's it like being a particularly a clergy person, but really what's it like being a person of faith in, let's call it, a post-religious country we're in right now. I know that's it's sort of a bland or generalization, and a lot of people might disagree with that we live in a post-religious country right now. But compared to many other countries in the world, compared to the global South where religion is booming. I can just speak from a Christian perspective. If you go to the global South, it is just, it's booming, but in the States, it's a different story. So we're going to talk about what does that mean? What does that look like, especially as clergy people? But I will say, before we dip into that, have you ever saying that you're a rabbi ever helped you get out of a ticket or something like that, where there was some kind of penalization going on, or there was a gate that didn't allow people to go somewhere, and you're like, what's
so,
that? You
so know, I love the question. Years ago, before coming down to Stewart, we were in upstate New York, and there was one of our festivals of Purim, where we dress up, kind of like the Jewish Halloween, so to speak. And I'm driving on the highway and getting down to a synagogue in Albany, New York, and I'm dressed in costume, and we are driving, and of course the speed limit on the interstate is 65. I may have been going 70 or a little bit faster. And I look behind me and flashing lights, and I pull over, and the officer had looked and said, you know, are you in a hurry? Where are you going? And I said, well, look, you know, I'm a rabbi just going down to do evening services and to prepare for our festival of Purim. And my wife and I were both literally dressed in crazy outfits. And he looks and he goes, okay, here's your ticket. So I said, okay. Go to court. The district attorney said, look, if you do a defensive driving course and defensive driving course, we will plead you down to 0 points, a small court fine. How do you find yourself? Okay, fine, guilty. So I'm sitting through this defensive driving course, and we go around the room, and the former officer is talking. Why are you here? And of the 15 people that were there, everyone gives their excuse. And he looks at me and says, so why are you here? And I said, because I'm court mandated. He said, court mandated? What happened? So I tell him the story. And he goes, what do you do for a living? So I said, well, you know, I'm a rabbi. And he looks and he goes, really? And he wrote you a ticket? And I said, well, what's the other option? And he said, normally we have a professional courtesy that says, okay, slow it down, you know, whatever it may be. But normally we give off on professional courtesies, which I was not given. But I don't like to use the rabbi card unless it's extreme cases. If I'm running late or am slammed in traffic and on the way to a funeral, for example.
Sure.
In those extreme cases, I would hope that our local law enforcement would be a little empathetic.
If you were on the way to, let's say you were not on the way to a funeral, to a wedding, to anything that involved a religious service, but you were cruising, you did get pulled over, would you maybe still slip it in, even though you were just going to Publix to pick up, you know, some cereal?
So years ago, so I'll give you the
other. Here it comes.
I'll give you the other extreme. The other extreme was, I think within the first couple of months, I was driving home from work. It was late at night. Speed limit may have been, I think, 35 miles an hour, and I was going 21 miles an hour. I was going under the speed limit. So I get pulled over. Do you know how fast you were going? How fast I was going? I mean, what about how slow going?
Yeah.
So he goes, where are you coming from? I said, well, you know, I'm coming from the temple. And, you know, what do you do? Well, the rabbi there, he comes back. He says, hang on. Aren't you on, don't you also serve as our chaplain? Yes, I do. Okay, rabbi. Speed it up, is the comment I got from the police officer. Speed it up.
Was that maybe a slight reference to maybe your sermons? Do you think he was trying to say, like, hey, tick-tock, buddy, in those sermons? Or no, was he's just going straight up with your
I think he driving. Was going. He was going straight up with the driving.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So either I go too fast or I go too slow. There's never that middle ground.
Yeah. There's been a couple times, I will say, where the priest card has definitely helped. And I don't try to play it outright or take advantage of it. But my driver's license does have me in a collar.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, and that wasn't planned. I promise you, I assure you, that was not planned. It was just the day that I went in to go get it. And I also had a horrible mustache on because it was Movember. So I had this like prepubescent, like 1 week mustache. So my driver's license right now for Florida is just me in like, not even the like right clericals, like a blue shirt, this big white collar and this horrible mustache. And I remember we were on Ghana. And we were, you know, my wife's from Ghana. We're in line to like we're leaving the country, and they can get pretty serious sometimes with the security, and they'll pull you into separate lines, and you get delayed for like an hour, and they're going to ask you all these questions, and you don't know if the person who's asking you is really security or really someone from the government or what. And so we were in line, and we got separated. Right. So we got separated. So she's somewhere else. I'm in a whole other part of the airport security. I'm like, oh my gosh, what happens if I get pulled aside and she can't find me? Of course, our international phone plan is not working because we're just using Wi-Fi and WhatsApp. And I'm sitting there and I'm next up, and the security woman, I give her my passport and they need a second ID. So I give her my driver's license as well, just to show. And she looks down and she looks at me. And she's looking at one side of the room where you go, where you're just delayed there for an hour, where they're just going to ask you a bunch of questions. And then she looks at the other side, and then she looks back down again. She says, you're a pastor. And I said, yes, ma'am. She's like, God bless you, brother. And she sent me over to the right.
Wow.
So that definitely helped, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So today what we're talking about, though, I mean, those are a couple things we have where being a cleric has, yes, sometimes it does open some doors, but there are times, though, we do. The reality is, it's not the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, where just because you are a cleric, just because you are a rabbi, just because I'm a priest, doesn't mean people say, "Oh my gosh, thank you, brother, for all the work that you do," and it's such an honorable thing.
But I think also sometimes it's the response that people don't know how to engage in. So years ago, So I'm Canadian, and there were times when we were living in upstate New York, we'd go visit family back in Toronto, and we'd cross over the border. And when we got married 10 years ago, when I had my bachelor party, my brothers thought it would be, I have three brothers, one in New York, one in Boston, and another one halfway between Toronto and Montreal. And my brothers thought it would be really funny. We went to medieval times for my one of my bachelor party events, and they thought it would be funny to buy me a decorative sword. So what am I going to do with a decorative sword, right? So I throw it in the trunk of my car. My parents had given us one of those coffee makers, Nespresso coffee makers. So I'm driving over the border, and the customs officer says, "So do you have anything to declare?" So I said, "Look, I know this sounds really strange, but I have a decorative sword and I have a coffee maker." And he goes, "Okay, what do you do?" I said, "Well, I'm a rabbi." And he goes, "Rabbi, huh? All right, let's go." He said, "Go where?" He goes, "Drive, go. Welcome to the United States." And I said, "Do you want to see what's in the back of my car?" And he goes, "Do I need to? Go." I thought, wow, I just drove over the border with a 42-inch decorative sword, and you know, that was it. It's that. Do I engage? Do I not engage? What do I say? Let's just leave it. Yeah. Let's just leave it.
Thank you, Border Security. That's good.
Yes. Yes.
A lot of, so this is, the sword got in, no problem. Yeah. Well, listen, we want to talk about a little bit today that there are, you know, I wear my collar usually when there's something sacramental going on, which is just churchy talk for if there's something like a major church-like service that demands a priest, where it's I'm celebrating the Eucharist, where a wedding, a funeral, I'm giving confession or taking confession. These are all things that are referred to as something sacramental within the Episcopal Church or the Catholic Church. So I put my collar on. And in other times I don't. Like right now, you and I are just in our kind of business casual clothes. Mm-hmm. But for you, you don't go out and wear a collar. I mean, the only time that you would wear anything that would signify that says to the world, "Hey, I'm a rabbi," would be a Shabbat service, correct? Or any other kind of formal worship service?
Well, I mean, I think for myself, I mean, I'm certainly not visible. You know, I don't wear the tzitzit, the fringes that are worn. I do wear a kippah, you know, the kind of skull cap. I do wear those if I am doing pastoral visitations. So if I'm at the hospital or I'm at a hospice or, you know, some form of that, I will put on a kippah just to, you know, put on, you know, to signify what I do, but also out of holiness and sanctity for what I do. On a Shabbat evening service on a Friday night, Saturday morning, I will wear tallit,
which What's that?
Is our ritual garment, kind of a prayer shawl. So I will wear that as I lead services. Clearly, I'm not wearing this when I lead services.
Can you explain the electricity of your shirt you have on right now?
The electricity,
Father.
So I did not know that this show was also being videoed.
Yeah. So if you go on to WSTU1450.com and you can watch it, you can stream this live, but you can also watch the YouTube airing that's on there, that's live. And so you can go in there and watch, and you can see what Rabbi Durbin's shirt is wearing, which is something out of the Roxbury.
Well, that's the thing, is that when we think about it, it's 13 episodes, which means it's 13 outfits that I'm going to have to put on. So last night, when I was thinking about this show, and I thought to myself, well, what am I going to wear today? So I literally put out five or six different outfits. I go, well, you know, do I want to wear this? Do I want to wear this? You know, what is Father Anderson going to wear? You know, and quite a fair amount of stress gets put into it on, you know, not only is it my voice that's being put out on the airwaves, but it's also the color of my shirt. So I decided I might as well go electric and go really bold this morning so that people, you know, could view that.
I wish we had more copyright leniency here so we could play It's Electric right now, because this would be just a perfect thing and that we can have inside of the radio show right now. Mr. Mike, the producer, what's the call-in number again?
That number is 220-9788-220-WSTU.
Yeah, so if you're streaming too, and if you're one of our friends that's out in California or New York, or even Toronto, where our rabbi's from. That's a 772 area code. So 772, one more time, Mike.
772-220-9788. 220-WSTU.
All right. We'd love to have a caller. So our topic today really is going to be, if you call in, do you think that we are really in a post-religious type era in America, just in America? If we talk about that, the religious leaders talk about that a lot. It's no surprise if you look at just from a numbers perspective that I can speak from the Christian perspective. A lot of churches are dealing with just a new understanding of how people are pursuing God. I don't see atheism is increasing. What I do see, though, is that people are seeking and searching for answers, and they're not just traditionally going to the church anymore. And so some churches are getting innovative and strong and good about listening to what people really want. What are they seeking? And providing worship programming that really kind of feeds the modern seeker, and sometimes that's not inside the church. Other churches that don't do that either can just be in a traditional place where people still just show up and go to church, but if they're in a place that people are just not in their culture to do that, they ain't showing up to church, right? And so I don't know if Judaism in America suffers the same thing, but it is this constant quandary and questioning in the church where, there's one way to look at it, which is very hopeful, which is like, wow, we're in a new era. We got to do new things. We got to be innovative. We got to listen to where God is taking us right now. We got to create ministries that really feed what people are seeking, which is, I mean, to me right now, it seems like people are looking for hope, looking for purpose, looking for just meaning in their life. And if they don't, they're turning to other kind of forms of self-medication or other ways to do it. They'll show up at yoga. They'll show up at AA because those places promise transformation when the church sometimes can just seem like a nice little country club. You get together and have a nice coffee. So now more than ever, church has got to do, it's got to really be, I guess, on their A game and get back to the basics of what really, why do we do church? All that to say is that if I go out and I have a collar on, knowing also the whole thing that's going on within the Catholic Church, and the collar that I wear usually is the Roman collar, I get two different reactions. I get people, well, let's say three different reactions. Here's a story just to sum it all up. I was at Men's Warehouse getting my when I was going through the whole wedding suit thing, right? And you're in there like 3-4 times, and I was up at the register. And there was a younger kid up there who was preparing all my clothes. And I was in my collar because I came from the office. And he said, "Hey, that's a really cool thing you got on. Is that kind of a Spanish? Is that sort of like a Spanish style?" And I was like, "Excuse me?" And his colleague turns to him and says, "Do you know what this guy does for a living?" And he says, "No." He's like, "Why don't you ask him?" He's like, "Sir, what do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm a priest." He's like, "Okay." And then his colleague says, "You don't know what a priest wears?" Like, "No, I just thought it was some kind of like cool little Spanish influence thing that came out that you were wearing." So he had no idea, A, what the collar meant. So we're in a place where people might not even recognize us. So that's one thing that people just think.
Do people treat you any different when you are in ritual garb as opposed to?
Yeah. So the second part is the one where it's just more optimistic or more of a positive way is where they'll see the collar, then they'll see me, they'll see that I'm youngish and I'm also 6'6", so I stick out like a giraffe, and they'll come over and they will actually be really hopeful to be like, "Oh wow, thank you for being a pastor or a priest and being a young one." That's what gets people around Florida, is that, you know, we have a, you know, very nice, healthy elderly population. And so they are hopeful to see that there's actually young priests. That's the good one. The bad, I want to say the negative, but the other reaction is people get extremely uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's because of an association with the issues that have happened in the church with the Roman collar, or if they just have issues with religion. I mean, everyone brings in a lot of history to it. So they're literally turned the other way. They don't want to look at me. So it's one of three, just complete ambivalence. Like, they have no idea. One where it's like, really they're hopeful, they're excited, and they'll even come up to me and ask for prayer. That's where we feel like the collar is really doing its job. It's a form of evangelism. And then the other one is just, no, I want nothing to do with you. And then I realize if I'm going to be engaging with this person for some reason, like I'm in the grocery line with them, it's up to me to kind of just just be me, mm-hmm. a regular dude, and kind of disarm someone to think I'm not going to try to judge or recruit or mm-hmm. convert with them. And I think the same thing happens with other Christian pastors who don't wear collars, who once they introduce themselves as a pastor, people get freaked out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get freaked out. If I meet another clergy person, I don't know where they're coming from. So we got to kind of sniff each other around, because you don't know if the person's have extremely different views than you. I mean, it's crazy. We both believe in Jesus Christ. We're both committing our lives to this walk, to this vocation. But yet we still need this time to kind of feel each other out, because their views might be so radically different. It's going to take a major amount of healthy dialogue for us to get on the same page. And that's nuts. That blows me away, knowing that we're both agreeing on the same Messiah, the same Savior. Hey, does any of this, you identify with anything I'm saying here, even though you don't wear a collar?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, once it's professionally, you know, it's known what I do. We get very much the same response, which is either there are some who engage and want to know more, you know, Rabbi, what is it like, you know, or will, you know, be in search of God or in search of meaning, you know, usually in those grocery store moments. But sometimes it is the complete disengagement, which is, oh, Rabbi, okay, well, you know, is there something that I can help you with? Is there something that, you know, we can work together on? I just want to pick up earlier when you had said about, you know, the church taking that proactive approach of welcoming people in, but at the same time adapting to where people are at a given moment. And I think certainly Reform Judaism has done the same thing. You know, we are housed under what we call the Union for Reform Judaism, which encompasses about 900 congregations in North America, housed under the World Union of Progressive Judaism, around 1,500 congregations worldwide. And what the union had done years ago was to look at, you know, congregations and their rabbis. What did the rabbis feel was needed for their communities to thrive and for their communities to be innovative in whatever they're doing? And in the last decade, two decades or so, it was the union now saying, we respect our rabbis, but we are more interested in our communities. So it was actually going, instead of to the rabbis, going to the membership of these communities to say, what is it that you need? What is it spiritually or engagement-wise that actually provides more meaning and more spirituality for you? And the union has done a pretty good job of doing that through audacious hospitality, to looking at moments that would create greater value and greater meaning. You know, from a synagogue perspective, we certainly have done the same, where we look at our membership and say, what is important to you? Is it the adult education piece? Is it the spirituality? Is it the counseling? Is it, you know, new or dynamic programming? Looks like we've got a caller. You know, we've done new programs at our temple. So every December ish when we celebrate the festival of Hanukkah, we have a big massive latke fest. Well, the congregation hadn't had it up to 5 years ago. This is our fifth annual latke fest. So please join us on December 2nd. I hope you will join us and cook. And you know, the thought is that we do, you know, have a dozen some odd cooks who create out of the box latkes. You know, potato pancakes, and you get to vote and taste all these different latkes and vote on your favorite one. And at the end, the winner wins the very, very heavily and coveted golden latke trophy.
Ooh.
Yeah.
The golden latke trophy. Okay. Yeah. Do you have one of those at home?
Well, I won it the first year.
Okay.
I subsequently have not won it over the last four. But it is, you know, it's something that I think engages the community as well as the wider community, you know, because I think part of it also is to demystify and to bring in others in our community to see what we Jews practice, you know, that we are a welcoming, that we are a community that embraces all walks of life, to be able to say, come experience what we preach, come experience what we believe, what we hold very sacred and dear to us, which is our values and ethics, as well as our rituals and customs that we do as Jews.
And that brings up, I mean, I think there is, you and I have talked about this before. I mean, people will say we live in a Judeo-Christian country, but at the end of the day, it's more of a Christian country where it is, sure, it might be in the 21st century sometimes. It's a little weird to say you're a Christian because people are like, really? I mean, I've had people, when I was in Los Angeles, I said, hey, man, I got to go to church. And they'd be like, you know, it's 2015 or whatever. I mean, they make a joke that like, that's a little archaic to go to church, but that's different than, that is still sort of like there's still an acceptance. It's not so awkward and strange where if you felt, and I'll just say as a Christian, that being around other people sometimes that still there's still this mystery or misunderstanding or lack of understanding of really what it means to be a Jew and Judaism, because there is so much history there of persecution. Mm-hmm. There's so much history there of being the fall guy in so many different cultures and societies that now more than ever, it seems to me that having these open and accessible ways where people to come and be with their Jewish brothers and sisters to learn what it's all about, the ethics, the values, the culture, is so important now because, and you could speak better to this to me, that I still think there is, I mean, we could say anti-Semitism, or we could just call it ignorance sounds judgmental, just a misunderstanding or a lack of knowledge or a lack of engagement with the Jewish population. And we can get into this more when we come back and break, but that, you know, just to tease this out a little bit, do you and do your the folks over at the synagogue still feel a tension or a weariness because of living in a society that sometimes you feel like, oh, they're not fully understanding or even accepting of, they get a little weirded out if they know that I'm a Jew.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a long, very long history, especially if we, you know, tackle the very difficult, you know, subject matter of anti-Semitism. Does it exist? Is it pervasive in our country, in our culture, in our world? You know, absolutely. It is certainly there, you know, whether it be in subtle ways or more overt ways, you know, it most certainly is there. And I think, you know, as you said, after break to tackle this important and difficult issue is certainly there. To speak on your comment where it, you know, the notion of going to church and people say, you know, this is the 21st century. And I remember as when I was in college, I would go to services every Friday night. And I remember friends saying, why are you going to services Friday night? And for me, I remember saying, because I think it was also about engagement and it was also about allowing others to understand why on a personal level I would go. And a part of me says, it's the one time a week where I have the ability to be able to shut the world out and say, please leave me alone. Mm-hmm. For this 1 hour or however long it is that I can commune with God, I can be with my community, I can listen and sing familiar melodies and liturgical moments of my service, but that I can be amongst, you know, I grew up in a very large Reformed synagogue. So, you know, I may be around a couple hundred people, but as I pray and as I'm with my community, that suddenly I almost feel a very personal connection to God. And a very personal connection to my community. And it was just one of those things that for that 1 hour on a Friday night that I could really be with myself and really shut out the stresses and the pressures of the everyday world to really be, to sit with myself, which was really powerful. Don't have that much of an opportunity now because as one who is leading the service, but there's something also that, you know, when we gear up and, you know, we're ready and it's a few minutes before those services that we provide on Friday nights and Saturday mornings to be able to have that sacred moment of, you know, being with myself before I address a community and knowing that it's not about me, as I'm sure you know, that when we lead services, it's not about you or me. It's about the people to whom we serve. And providing that very intimate or that very personal connection to God and to our community and to our faith is quite powerful. And I think at that moment that we provide those moments of experience allow us to transform into conduits of expressive meaning.
Yeah, I think that's that's a pretty good evangelistic statement right there, my brother. So I don't know if you guys throw around the word evangelism.
We do not.
But I would love to talk more about that, about how, what is the Jewish approach to evangelism and spreading the word? Because what you said right there, and especially in a 21st context, knowing, and you and I both know what people bring into our office day in and day out, the struggles that they have, and to say, coming to this sacred space, coming into this sacred area, even though that the church and the synagogue wants to get out into the world and make it more accessible, there's still this prize of saying, there is this sacred space that you can go to for an hour. And God lives everywhere, of course, but you walk into this place where these walls are just soaked in prayer, where you can just leave everything else at the door and allow yourself to just breathe and be present with the divine, wherever you're at in your spiritual journey, whether you're going to name and say it's Yahweh, you're going to say it's Jesus Christ, wherever you're at in your walk, but you can come in here and be welcome, be accepted, and just tune out and just be present. Allow this music to wash over you. Allow this liturgy to wash over you. Allow your heart to open. You can cry. You can weep. You can sing, you can be tears of joy, whatever you want. That can happen here. And there's not many institutions right now that you can just have the freedom to walk into and just have that experience.
But I think, you know, you said it just there as well, is, you know, is it about the four walls of an institution? You know, when I was in upstate New York, we had the opportunity to do, we created Shabbat on the Slopes. So we do, you know, we do a Shabbat morning service, Saturday mornings on the base of the mountain, and then we would spend the rest of the day skiing. You know, a way of saying God lives everywhere and anywhere. We don't have to be in the four walls of a sanctuary. You know, we do here, we do beach Shabbats. So when the weather gets better and it's not, you know, 290 degrees with 7,000% humidity, when it calms down a little bit, you know, we meet at the beach. We do Friday night service at the beach itself, which I think for us as a community, it's actually quite innovative. You know, there's not that many, you know, synagogues that have the ability, you know, unless you're in California or you're on the coast, to be able to really provide that different type of experience. And my favorite with Shabbat on the beach is being able to look out into the ocean and to see that, just that vastness of God's creation, and to be able to, as we pray, to look out to the water, to see the crash of the waves, to see the expansive sky that is out there, and to know that God is everywhere, and being able to really take that in is just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of our fastest growing services, or one of more services, really surprised us as we started doing our baptisms on the beach. So on Easter morning, that's a big baptism day. So you have four or five candidates who've been nurtured and walking through this walk to prepare themselves for baptism. And usually that's done in the church, and get the small little font, and you have this tiny little shell, and you put a little bit of water over their head. So we had people are like, no, I want to get dunked. I want to go in the ocean. Mm. So then we, you know, show up at like 5 a.m, have to, you know, this on Easter morning, if you show up at the beach, you got to, you know, you got to do the whole turtle thing. Mm. So you can't turn on any lights, because the woman in the four wheeler is going to show up and shut down the whole show, which I've learned.
Wow.
So what you get through that, but and we set up the altar, we set up this whole place, and we have these five candidates, and it becomes, I don't know if you've experienced this public invitation to come be a part of this mm-hmm. worship service. So random folks at the beach will show up. The sun's coming up. We finally got the guy with the guitar playing, and it gets to the big moment where we bring 6, 7, how many people out into the ocean, while the rest of these people, sometimes 100, 140 people, can just sit in the beach and just be in awe of God's beauty, right? Of hearing the ocean, of seeing the sun coming up, of looking around, of just God's glory. You know, this is Psalm 9 talks about, right? No, Psalm 8, my bad. And just the beauty, and just like, wow, look at the creator. And I agree with you here, how important it is to get out sometimes, to get out of the four walls and into the beauty of God's creation, because that just blows people's mind, especially if they can't, if they don't have a language yet to put on who is this divine, who is this higher power, but they can see it and feel it and taste it and hear it and be like, okay, there's something going on here. There's a holy creator here that I want to surrender my life to. Mm. So, all right, we're going to throw it a break here. And when we come back, we want to dig a little more deeper into this idea, though, of this is extreme word, but anti-religious, or that can either be anti-Semitic or can be the tension that you feel as a Christian. And now the reality is the 21st century. And if you have any thoughts on this too, please give us a call, 772-220. That's WSTU. And WSTU, Mike, again, what's the number on that?
The radio number?
Yeah.
It's 1450 AM and the phone number 220-9788-220-WSTU.
9788. All right. We'll see you in just a sec. You want me? You want me?
You have the good radio voice.
And we're back. Go ahead, guys.
Hey. So we're back here. It is a priest and a rabbi on 1450 AM on that AM dial. And you can always, if you're away and you want to watch this on YouTube, you can just go to the website on WSTU1450.com where you can listen to it and watch it. And we're here in the studio. And, you know, just a shameless plug from time to time. We'll plug stuff that's happening on at the synagogue and at the church. But you just heard a little commercial for what's going on at St. Mary's coming up on October 28th that we are going to have our annual trunk or treat. So we're not going to door, we're going to trunk. So I don't know if you all do this over at the temple, but you guys are more than welcome to come. You roll up, you open up your trunk, you decorate it, kids get all dressed out and are handing out candy. And then after that, we go straight into the Pittenger Center where we also have this big chili cook-off. People get really into the chili. And it's just, you know, $5 for the chili, and all that's going towards our outreach, all the different things we do in the community, Backpack Buddies and Samaritan House, and supporting a lot of other great organizations, social services that are just doing things to make Martin County a more healing and loving place. So, but that's coming up on October 28th, and you can find all that stuff at the website for the church, www.stmarys-stewart.org. You guys got something coming up?
Well, I mean, we so the way our Jewish calendar works is we just kind of had like the Super Bowl of holidays, from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur to Sukkot to Simchat Torah to rejoicing around the Torah. We start our cycle all over again, and then we get to this moment in our Jewish calendar, which we enter into a month which we call the month of Cheshvan, which is the Hebrew month, but the rabbis have always called it Mar Cheshvan. And the word mar in Hebrew is the same word that we use on Passover for maror, bitter. We eat bitter herbs to remind us of the bitterness of being slaves in Egypt. And the rabbis call it, you know, Mar Cheshvan, because it's a bitter, bitter, bitter month, because we are devoid of Jewish holidays. So for that, you know, 5-6 week period, we don't really have a lot of Jewish holidays coming up. We have a lot of Adult Ed programs. We have a lot of social events in the congregation. But the next major event that we're going to have is December 2nd on Sunday between 11 and 1 of our fifth annual Latke Fest, which is great. Really well attended, and it's a lot of fun.
All right.
It's tasty.
That's the one with the trophy.
That's the trophy.
That's the trophy one.
And maybe this year, Father Anderson, maybe you could take home that.
Has a Gentile ever take? Has it ever won the award?
It has not as of yet.
Okay, as of yet.
Everything is possible.
Yeah, I'll talk to the wife and see what we can come up with here.
You just got
to
make 300.
Okay.
But yeah. They're tiny. They're
okay.
Tiny.
We'll talk. We'll talk off air. All right, so let's get right to it. So, my friend, Rabbi, have you ever experienced anything that you could relate to calling it anti-Semitic as your stay here in Stewart, Florida?
Not so much here in Stewart. I mean, although I've only been here, this is entering my fifth year here, I haven't really heard directly any comments to me. We have heard from, you know, some of our children, some of our kids who have experienced, unfortunately, derogatory comments or jokes in some nature that, you know, for us as Jews is rather offensive. As a child, I grew up, as I said, in a very large city. I went to a Anglican high school. Church of England was established in 1829 by the king. And at that time, not that I was around in 1829, but when I was in high school, there was always that underlying awkward strangeness that has always occurred. You know, we had Jews in our high school, not as much as the general population. And I remember when we were in high school, we had prayers every single morning. So we'd say the Lord's Prayer. As Jews, we were slightly opted out, although if we didn't recite it, we would have to go to the principal's office and explain ourselves. And numerous times we would be taken to the principal's office. And, you know, for years, the Jewish community, the Jewish students would complain and say, look, you know, every year you have a massive Christmas tree that's put on the hall as we, you know, as students go in, 600-700 students go in to say prayers every single morning. And for years, the college would never really honor or even respect in any some way the Jewish community. And nearing the end of my time in high school, the college had come back and said, okay, we'll give you two things. So when it came to around the winter celebrations, they had the ginormous Christmas tree. And right next to it was like a minuscule, very tiny little Hanukkah menorah. Okay, at least we've been heard. And then they said, not only have we given you a Chanukiah, your Hanukkah menorah, we're also going to give you a song. So we thought, wow, this is great. What uplifting and joyful and just incredible song are you going to give us? And they start singing, go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land, let my people go. Right. And we just thought of all our rich and beautiful history, you give us that. But, you know, so that was just that was in some way when I was growing up, when I was in college, I did an English. I was studying English with one of our professors. I would say 85% of the class was Jewish. And as we were doing, I can't remember what it was, Sir Gawain the Green Knight or something. And he had said, well, we're all good Christians here. Okay. So as, you know, 40 hands rise up and say, you know, sir, professor, we, not all of us are Christian. Majority of us are Jewish. And he said, maybe you didn't hear what I said. We are all good Christians here. And we're saying, no, maybe you didn't hear what we had said, which was, we're Jewish. Again, and maybe it went back at that moment to the Judeo-Christian values or ethics that we subscribe to. But it was that notion of whether we call it ignorance or just not knowing or refusing to acknowledge. You know, there was something there.
He wasn't going to budge and recognize that.
Absolutely not.
That you guys were not Christians.
No.
So was he trying to make the relationship that Jesus was a Jew?
He could have.
But Jesus didn't say he was a Christian.
But I think that goes back to the open dialogue and open communication of, you know, let's engage in a conversation where he just did not want to engage at all.
Yeah. So where is this fear? And we've talked a little bit about this before. I think there still is this fear of unknowingness or this mystery or this of the Jewish culture. And I know that there's been obviously horrific stories and a history there, but now he's still in the 21st century that there's, I still think when people who are either Gentiles or non-Jews speak about the Jewish culture, there's still like maybe a tap dance around it because do you think it's from an unknowingness and like they've never been around or had, I mean, certainly where it's America, they've had Jewish friends and been engaged with. I mean, I grew up in an area where going to bat mitzvahs was totally normal. Mm-hmm. You know, the Chicago suburbs is just, you know, what you did. So there was an engagement there. But I've been around and I'll say it. I mean, even in Martin County, I've been around folks who will say comments and they might think it's kind of funny and they're not trying to maybe be fierce or hurtful or have anything against Jewish folks, but they'll do the same thing, like making a comment like, oh yeah, this guy was being really tight with his money. He was being very Jewy.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2018. Are you serious? Like,
when I served in my first congregation in upstate New York, the community had a rummage sale, which was, for lack of a better term, it was people brought in their undesirables, and then other folks would come in and buy it as if it was treasures. And that moment, I mean, we would get hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that would come. And I remember on that one Sunday, sitting in my office and having two women pass by and say a comment, wow, I got an amazing deal on that item. I really Jewed them down. And I remember thinking to myself, Jewed them down? This is New York. And this is the 21st century. I've never heard that comment before. And by the time after it had sunk in, by the time I realized what had happened, I left my office to try and, you know, confront these two ladies to be able to express. And by that time, they were gone. And I agree with you. I think that there are comments that are said that may be innocent in nature or maybe not. But I think people need to be very empathetic and have that understanding of how may it be perceived or taken by somebody else. You know, when I was in rabbinical school, I lived in London. And London, of course, is, it's probably the most Christian country in the world, or one of the most Christian countries.
Historically. The numbers would say now that there's a lot of cathedrals that are empty. Yeah.
And I lived at that time through rabbinical school. I lived on a Jewish cemetery. It was a caretaker's house. It was given to the community. My colleagues and I lived in this house. And I remember one evening I was studying, preparing for class for the next day, and you know, a whole slew of British youths were walking down the street, and I could hear that they were very just antagonistic, and I could hear comments that they would say about, you know, the challenge with the world's problems today are the Jewish people, and I remember just being really struck. My window faced the street; I could hear it, and at that moment, when I looked out, I had one of these British youths grab a head of broccoli and tossed it very forcefully through my window.
Broccoli because it's a symbol of it's, something.
No, it's a vegetable.
Right, but is there significance to broccoli that I'm missing on this?
No,
derogatory term.
I think
I'm trying to go through the Hebrew scripture right now, and I'm thinking of Leviticus, the thou shalt, like the broccoli.
Just a vegetable that happened to be in one's pocket.
So it could have been squash. It could have been
a mushroom. You know, whatever it was. And I remember when I went back to my college, and voiced my concern. For, you know, the level, as we know, in Europe, there is a rise of anti-Semitism, and saying, you know, I'm really concerned, and, you know, we are visible, and we are a major, where the house was located is actually a major tourist area for the area. You know, across the street where I lived was Golders Green Crematorium, and in urned there is Sigmund Freud and Anna Pavlova, and across the street we had Rabbi Leo Beck and Jacqueline Dupre. So, you know, it was a pretty well-known, famous area. And my college, bless them, had said to me, what's the problem? I said, well, you know, I was a little concerned. You know, they were very aggressive, and they had thrown this head of broccoli through my window. And they had said, did you make a salad? And I remember saying, make a salad? Are you kidding? Because a lot of this, I think, goes back to, you know, beyond, you know, the 21st century. You know, we have a lot of animosity. We have a lot of challenge, you know, beyond the Holocaust, where so many of our people were innocently murdered and tortured. And but I think, you know, even if we go back 1,000 years ago, you know, there is the ancient myth of the blood libel. And for those that are not familiar with that, is that we as Jews, the ancient ritual myth that we as Jews took the blood of Christian babies, mixed it into our dough that we prepare to make matzah on Passover, which just is such a fallacy, because as Jews, we don't eat blood. We don't do any of that. But, you know, in 1144 in Lincoln, in the north part of England, you know, that story circulated. And it went from there to other parts of the country, to other parts of Europe, of being not only are we ritually killing babies, Christian babies, that we were eating Christian babies, that we were ritual cannibals. And I think, you know, a large part of that whole history gets embedded in our culture, that it's very difficult for us as Jews to kind of set the story straight, if that makes sense. That, you know, these things didn't happen, but because it festers and it grows and it becomes so ingrained in society. Even if we look back to, you know, Michelangelo's very famous depiction of Moses. You know, when Christianity got a hold of it 1,000 years ago,
right? That was the horns.
The whole notion was that it was mistranslated.
Right.
You know, the horns themselves in Hebrew, Karim. Well, okay, when Christianity got a hold of it, they took the one translation, which was horns. But when God speaks to Moses and the rays of light emanated from Moses' face, it happened to look like horns.
So this is what I'm thinking. Summarizing all this up, I think the best thing to do is to get over to the temple.
Get over the temple.
Get over the temple. You hang out. I've been over there before and engage. And we've had good dialogues. I think you and I keep on having dialogues at our respective parishes. But also to go for Shabbat. They have a wonderful meal afterwards. You get to hang out and be with the people. Because I think there's just a lot of basic myths that are still in our cellular structure that's there over thousands of years. So anyways, get out. Come over to St. Mary's. Come over to Besh Hayam. Okay? And just hang out with the folks. Get to know us. And we're going to see you next Friday at 9 a.m. And soon we're actually going to be talking, getting a little deeper here and talking about, hey, how does religion talk about sex? Mm-hmm. How does religion talk about sex? We'll have a really good guest on there, which might be another rabbi who might also be sleeping with the rabbi next to me because it's his wife. Mm-hmm. So we'll see you then. God bless you.